Summer loving had me a blast.
Summer loving happened so fast.
Met a girl crazy for me.
Met a boy cute as can be.
Summer day drifting away to all the summer nights.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, August 8th, 2010. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning, actually, we have three people instead of our normal two. We have Matthew Murray, Peter Felicia, and Michael Portantier. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com and also writes for the New York Star Ledger as well as Masterworks Broadway. Hello, Peter. How are you?
Fine. Welcome from Wichita.
Yes, Peter's out in Wichita. We'll get to that in a second, talking a little bit about that. Also with us on the call this morning is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for TalkinBroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Hi, Matthew.
Welcome from New York.
Excellent. The fourth member of the trio, if I can say that.
The fourth member of the trio.
Is Michael Portantier. Michael has more than 30 years of experience as an editor and writer for TheaterMania.com, In Theater Magazine, and Backstage. He's interviewed theater notables for NPR.org, Playbill, Stagebill, and Opera News, and has written notes for several cast albums. He's also the co-author of Forbidden Broadway, Behind the Mylar Curtain, published in 2008 by Hal Leonard and Applause. And additionally, he's a professional photographer whose pictures have been published in the New York Times, the Daily News, and several major websites, including Broadway Stars. Michael also writes for BroadwayStars.com. So good morning, Michael.
Good morning, James.
So, Peter has to run in a little while, so let's get Peter's stories out of the way quickly. Tell us why you're in Wichita.
I'm in Wichita to see Curtains, the John Cantor, Fred Ebb musical that played on Broadway a few years ago at Music Theater of Wichita. Now, that may not sound like much for those of you who've never been out here. Music Theater of Wichita, you're expecting that this is some small operation, but it hardly is. It's a theater that seats 2,800 people. If you've been to the Paper Mill Playhouse, it looks exactly like the Paper Mill Playhouse, only bigger. I wouldn't be surprised if it were the same architect. So what's really wonderful is how much this town supports this theater. It's been in existence 39 years, and they do five shows a summer, only for a week, but they really do very well in coming close to, if not filling, the theater itself. This year, they did Crazy for You, Annie, Gypsy, Smokey Joe's Cafe, and now Curtains. And it's very exciting to see so many people come out and see a show and treat this as a real local treasure. I guess we shouldn't be so surprised that Wichita is interested in musical theater, because after all, the last five letters of Wichita are cheetah, you know. So as a result, maybe that's really why, you know, there's just this natural affinity for musical theater. But what was really nice, last night, John Cantor himself came down to see the show. He was up in Minneapolis, and he was working, of course, on Scottsboro's Boys, but he came down just to see it last night, and he's leaving in a little while. We're taking him to the airport, which is why I can't stay on too long. But he was so tremendously pleased, and he wasn't at all ready to come to a theater where there were going to be 2,800 people. He just had no idea it was going to be that type of setup. I mean, this is a real big proscenium stage. And I mean, what was really impressive, there's a scene deep in the second act where they're doing a scene involving a song called In the Same Boat. So a backdrop comes in, you know, of a lake. Fine. And then a little later, another backdrop comes in of a lake. And I mean, this is really a Broadway-sized house. And for them to go to the trouble of having two backdrops for this one scene, I thought was really terrific. So they really spend money on it. The design is very similar to the Broadway production. So if one missed it on Broadway, one could really see it here and be tremendously impressed by the scope of the production. What was also endearing at the end of the show, when Cantor was meeting everybody, one girl came up to him and told him that she was very excited because she just got cast in Leap of Faith, which is coming to Broadway. And he said, oh, that's really wonderful. What theater are you going into? And she said, I don't know. We haven't decided yet. And he said, I just hope it's not the Lyceum. And the reason that's funny is, of course, the Scottsboro Boys is going into the Lyceum, and Kander is hoping that that show is going to run and that the Lyceum won't be available for some time. So, but a good time was had by all, and it's really nice to be here.
Great. Peter, we haven't spoken to you in a few weeks. You were traveling last week and the week before. You have any stories to share with us?
Yeah, I was in St. Louis, where I saw a musical from the 50s, a musical from the 60s, and a musical from the 70s. I saw Sound of Music at the Muni, which is an 11,000-seat theater, and almost every seat was filled, by the way, which was really quite nice. Ashley Brown was playing Maria, and Jessica Grove was playing Liesel, which is interesting because I believe Jessica Grove has a few years on Ashley Brown. I think she's older. But in a theater with 1,100 seats, who notices that, you know, that Jessica Grove is well into her 30s? You really can't tell.
11,000.
What did I say?
1,100. Yeah, 11,000.
Yeah, I'm used to that figure. 11,000, yes. What's also interesting is that Louis J. Stablin played Max. He was here to do it. And during the How Can Love Survive number, which I'm happy to say they did, he made a symbol of a Mercedes, you know, for that lyric about Mercedeses. And I'm thinking, gee, you know, with his fingers, he made that symbol. And I thought, gee, you know, I wonder if this is worth doing in a theater with 11,000 people, you know, beyond the fourth row. I don't know if you could see it. So that was a musical from the 50s. And the musical from the 60s was Promises, Promises, which was very well done. And one thing that I've seen Promises, Promises back from the original production in 68. But the one thing that happened in this one that's never happened before that really made me well up with tears at the end of the first act, when Chuck Baxter discovers that the girl he's loved has had a more sordid past than he expected. I mean, the kid who was playing it, and I mean kid, was so young that you really saw a boy lose his innocence. And that was really very, very touching to see it happen. I've never been that touched before, because after all, we think of Promises, Promises as a slam-bang musical comedy. But, you know, when you look at it, it is darker than you think. I mean, there's a suicide attempt, you know, there's adultery. There's even talk, a little bit of oblique talk about abortion in the show, too. So it's very interesting. It's a darker show than we think. And not that the director, Michael Hamilton, played it for dark, but he played it for emotion, and that's what was really interesting. And the show from the 70s was Evita, done by Scott Miller's New Line Theater. Scott Miller is an excellent writer. He's written so many wonderful books about musical theater, with titles like Deconstructing Harold Hill and From Assassins to West Side Story and Strike Up the Band, all terrific books. And he's a good director, too. And he really did a very nice production of Evita with 16 people. And what was most interesting to me is that he had a middle-aged woman play Perone's mistress. And it made it far more poignant, because when a young girl gets thrown out of the apartment by Evita, you really do feel, well, she's young, she's pretty, she'll be all right. But when it's an older woman, you know, she has to worry a little bit more about what her future is going to be. So I thought that was a particularly interesting change. But it was a very, very fine production. So, you know, St. Louis is really, really terrific. And it's very nice to see such a burgeoning musical theater scene there. This week, by the way, I'll be back in Missouri because I've been asked to go see this all-female production, well, concert production of 1776 that they're doing out in Kansas City. So the next time we talk, I'll be able to talk about that. So that'll be fun, too.
All right. So how, you know, when you went to the Muni, where were you, where did you see the show from? Did you see it front, middle, back, from the sides? What was your experience there?
I would say I was about 15 rows back, and I was on the left side of the stage from the audience viewpoint, I would guess. And yes, to a degree, the actors do look like trained fleas. But, you know, when I left the theater, I walked all the way up to the back just to see what it would look like from the real upper regions. And by the way, the last 9 rows of the theater are free. You don't have to pay anything to sit there. And I'm sure a lot of families go there and get their entertainment without having to spend a fortune. And if you know the show, it's kind of fun, you know, to even see it from that vantage point, you know, from far away. I didn't stay for the whole thing. I left after Edelweiss, and I'll tell you why. The parking lot, imagine getting out with, you know, 11,000 people, you know. So I thought I'd better, you know, having taken the, I took the advice that I heard the day before from Fran Kubelik, which is go while the going is good, you know, knowing when to leave, you know. So that's what I did.
There are people still getting out right now.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes, I agree.
A week later.
I agree entirely, you know, so.
The reason I brought up the size was because Neil Patrick Harris just directed a amphitheater at the Hollywood Bowl. He directed Rent that played this weekend, and people were commenting that they brought out really large jumbotrons to show on the screen. And I said, you know, I wonder if they're doing that at large things like the Muni. I don't remember any large screens being at the Muni, but I wanted to see what your thought on that was and if that takes away from the performance. And I think to myself that maybe we should all weigh in here if that's helpful or not. Is it counterproductive? You know, you're bringing 11,000 people who may not get to see live theater, but then you're putting it up on a screen. You know, they do that in Central Park with really large performances, like when Pavarotti was in the park, but that's a little bit different than theater. What do you think about bringing a large jumbotron in?
I bet it's inevitable. It never even occurred to me until you mentioned this, but I wouldn't be surprised if the day comes when that happens and is accepted, because too many people will have had the experience of seeing this not only in concerts, but also in sports stadia. So I think it's something that will happen at these places as time goes on. And, I mean, I don't like it as much. But I also know that when the world gets you used to something, there is no fighting it. So I think that if it hasn't happened at the Muni yet, it won't be surprising to me at all if in the next few years it's there. But I would be interested to hear what our other panelists here have to say about this.
Michael, you know, in thinking what they do at the Metropolitan Opera with subtitles and supertitles and other types of video distractions, would you compare that to the same thing, or how do you feel about the whole video thing in general?
Well, the Met, you know, they have the titles on the back of the seats, and they made a big point of that when it was installed, because it. Super titles had already been done at the New York City Opera, but there they're projected on the proscenium, you know, at the top of the stage. So I think those are two very different things. I mean, the great thing about having it on the back of the seat is that you just it's there for you if you need it, but if somebody else doesn't want it, they don't have to see it. So I think it's kind of a different situation, but it is worth pointing out that we have had some Broadway shows that have had video elements. The one that immediately leaps to mind is Rock of Ages, but there have been several others. I just can't quite think at the moment. So I don't know if it's a trend and if it will keep going more and more of it, but I guess we'll see.
Well, didn't they use video in the Sondheim on Sondheim?
Oh, sure, yeah. But that was a little different, because that was specifically, sort of documentary thing, yeah.
Matthew, what do you think about this?
Jumbotron-type monitors were used in The Blonde and the Thunderbird.
I blocked it out.
But
that's right.
Yes, I will just point out, Michael, that Rock of Ages doesn't really do that. Rock of Ages, well, I guess they have a little bit, but that is to cover action that's taking place off stage. Most of the time, they just have that LED wall that displays kind of scenic elements and all that. The elaborate entrance of Chad Deity, which was off-Broadway earlier this season, and I don't remember if we ever talked about it on the podcast, but boy, that was a really good show. It took place in a wrestling arena, and it was all about wrestlers, so they had the elaborate video setups. But again, that was to convey information that was not to be seen on stage, that they couldn't really stage in the traditional sense. Personally,
right.
I'm not in favor of showing close-up video while a show is going on. That's antithetical to theater to me. And I really don't have any interest in seeing it. And of course, like I said, The Blonde and the Thunderbird did it. But since that wasn't really theater, that doesn't exactly count. But I mean, I know that they do that kind of thing with concerts and things. That is a little bit different because you're... Well, I don't really approve of it with concerts either, but it is a little bit different in that they're trying to put the focus on one thing. And if you have a soloist doing a concert, it's kind of a different situation in my mind. But if you have a story and you're telling a story, to have it put on the TV screens at the same time, I think is an enormous distraction and takes away from the fact that theater is supposed to be about people sitting and watching other actors on a stage. So I really hope it doesn't go that way, but I'm with Peter. I'm sure it's just a matter of time. Peter, I did have one question for you. I've never been to the Muni, so I'm curious. I knew that it seated 11,000, but do they typically sell out there?
I don't know if they typically sell out. Actually, this was only my second time here. I was there last year to see Camelot, where indeed the attendance was very healthy as well. I will admit that Sound of Music was the closing night, and that may have something to do with it. It was Sunday night, so under those circumstances, maybe people come out more. But I'm telling you, I won't say every seat was taken, no. I did see a few scattered seats here and there that were empty, which may mean they very well were paid for and people decided not to go. Or people still try to get from the parking lot to get in, too. It's entirely possible. But I would be astonished if there were any fewer than 10,500 people there that night.
You know, I think about those people who I want to trip that run out of the theater before the curtain call on Broadway because they got to get their car out of the garage or something like that to get home to Jersey. If at the Muni...
Guilty as charged. Guilty as charged.
Yeah.
You know, another thing too is that I didn't know where I was going in terms of.
No, and I'm not blaming you at all. I'm just thinking that at the Muni you have to like start after the entr'acte, you know, to get to the car in time.
So,
Peter, before you run, do you have any other? Did you see anything this week you want to share with us before you?
I also went off Broadway to see a play called Rabble. It looks like Ravel. Same spelling, but it really is Rabble, and it's at the Looking Glass Theater on 57th Street, and it's a fascinating play about a lesbian woman who has just broken up with her girlfriend, and the Greek fates have a lot to do with what happens in her life, especially with her mother and her grandmother. It's very intriguing. It's very nicely directed by a young woman named Alex Mallory, who I think may very well have some talent, so it was fun to go to that. At this little hole in the wall on 57th Street between 9th and 10th, where you go downstairs and knock three times and whisper low to get in. You know, I really enjoyed the three performances as well. I will grant you the grandmother was much too young, but all these three women also played the Greek fates, and they doubled. And it there were things about the life of frogs that came into it, too, and frogs raining. But, I mean, it always held my attention. I wasn't the least bit bored, and considering that it was a hot night, as we've had so many, and we had to rely on fans, I found it very interesting that I forgot about the heat and just paid a good deal of attention to this situation. So, but that was it because I've been traveling so much. You know, I mean, it's I've barely been in New York. By the time I get in late on Monday and then leave on early Friday morning, you know, and I have to catch up and do a lot of writing. So, no, I haven't seen as much as I would like to have seen.
No, so it is. You know, it is the summer, and we do get out of town to see things in the regions, and you know, and Lord knows that as September rolls around, things are lining up to be a very busy fall for the three of you to see lots of things and write about lots of things. So with that coming up, Peter, you're welcome to stay on as long as you can if you'd like, or head out.
I want to hear what Michael and Matthew have seen. You know,
okay.
So I'm very interested in that.
Is anyone interested in talking about what Emma Thompson said about Audrey Hepburn?
Wasn't that something?
Wait, I didn't hear this. What did she say?
She said, I'm not usually, she's talking, you know, she's doing a, she's writing a remake of My Fair Lady, Emma Thompson is. And she says that I'm not usually fond of the film that exists. She says, I find Audrey Hepburn fantastically twee. When asked by the Hollywood Reporter what twee means, Thompson says, twee is whimsy without wit. It is mimsy, mumsy sweetness without any kind of bite, and that's not for me. She can't sing and she can't really act, I'm afraid.
Well, so. Nobody can argue with the can't sing because, of course, Hollywood made that decision for her.
Right.
But, gee, I think she's quite nice in My Fair Lady. I enjoy her performance very much. I know that movie gets criticized a lot for being stuffy and staid and all that, but whenever I watch it, I really get great pleasure from it. I think it's a very nice transfer, and about as much as we could have hoped for in 1964. I mean, there are no snazzy camera techniques or anything like that, and there are things about it that I will admit aren't as interesting as things I've seen in subsequent My Fair Lady productions, but nevertheless, I think it's a good movie. So, and I have no problem with Audrey Hepburn's performance in it.
Yeah, kind of amazing. I mean, it's very unusual.
Can't really act.
And by the way, Emma Thompson made this statement on the occasion of her being inducted into the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Wow.
And somehow she, yeah, I mean, if you had to pick one person who, you know, not to criticize because they're so beloved, it would probably be Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said to that, Matt, Michael. Yeah, I agree with that.
And I really do think that she, I mean, she's not perfectly cast in My Fair Lady, but as you say, she still gives a wonderful performance. Even
sure.
Julie Andrews has even says that she thought she did quite a good job with the role.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was interesting. And well,
of course,
it remains to be seen if we ever see this remake of My Fair Lady.
Maybe, right.
Maybe now less so, less of a chance.
To be fair, she certainly, Emma Thompson certainly has the Oscars on her side because, believe me, there was such a hue and cry back in 1965 when the nominations came out, and Audrey Hepburn was not included in the nominations. And that was really very surprising to a great number of people. So I understand the decision from the vantage point that she was dubbed. You know, one can say, well, she obviously didn't give a complete performance because she was dubbed. So I understand it from an award point of view, but nevertheless, just from watching the movie and saying, can this lady act? Yes, I say she can.
And it's interesting.
That's a tough role, too, you know?
Yeah. Oh, of course. No, it's just interesting because Deborah Carr, of course, had been dubbed in The King and I, and she was nominated, but I believe the idea was that at that point in 1956, it was all very, very hush-hush. And then it sort of started to become more and more open. And of course, interestingly enough, it's the same woman who dubbed both actresses,
sure.
Marnie Nixon.
Yes, I don't think there was a day in 1963 that Marnie Nixon's name didn't show up either in the newspaper or on the news. It was an astonishing thing back then how everybody knew that name, everybody.
Yeah.
So you're right. I was a little young to know what was going on with the filming of The King and I, but I have a feeling you're right, Michael, that it wasn't a case of people knowing that Marnie Nixon was dubbing Deborah Carr.
I was thinking that maybe since we don't have many things that we can talk about, maybe we should talk about them then hold the podcast until they open.
Well, I did have something, James. I don't know. I mentioned it to Matthew. He didn't know if you'd want to get into it, but I also saw this play called Wolves, which is in the Black Box space at 59 East 59th.
Uh-huh.
And I guess it just struck me as an example of the kind of thing that, you know, it's not the greatest play ever written, but it's all, you know, it's a play and it's about relationships and it's small and it's not large and there's nothing sensationalistic in it. And it struck me that it seems that almost anything now needs to be big or sensationalistic in some way in order to succeed, unless it's, you know, in a little theater that's going to run for like 2 weeks.
Well, I mean, it's counterintuitive to the Fantastics, and also we talked about the David Babani and the Meunier Chocolate Factory last week. You know, that's really what their thing is. You know, this, you keep it small and keep it simple.
Well, but it doesn't apply to revivals, and also it doesn't apply if there's a star involved. My point is that people need a hook. People need some kind of a hook now, is the thinking, to get them into the theater. You can't just do a play that's good. Mm-hmm. It has to either have a star or two, or it has to be, production has to be like incredibly, tremendously produced, or
it comes up against if we had just the most amazing performance in the world in Fences last season without Denzel, would it have flown?
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's something, that's the year. we sort of blame Fran and Barry Weisler about it, but it's been happening long before them.
I think that's a major change that has happened in the theater. Maybe we don't always phrase it in that way. It applies to television and film too. I think there's just so many options for entertainment between TV and film and the internet and satellite radio and theater, and that people, and you can't blame them in a way, but they feel like they need to do something that's going to get a lot of attention. So if they don't have a star, or if they don't have a falling chandelier or whatever, they'll write something about that has sex on stage, or something about some plot element that's incredibly out of the ordinary. And when you get something that doesn't have that, it's so interesting. Next fall. Maybe 10 years ago, it would have run just for the curiosity factor about the gay relationship. Yeah. But now there are so many of those. Like in next fall, if the religious guy had killed his partner, and freaked out and killed him, I bet you that show would have run a year and 2 years.
Well, especially if he killed him in a gruesome, never heard of before way of killing him, they would have really had a shot. But it's really interesting. When I started going to theater in the 60s, it was routine that people would look for stars in shows, especially in musicals. And, of course, that changed as time went on, because it takes musicals so long to pay back now. And as a result, it's a liability to have a star, because the star's going to leave after a year. And then you're left with people saying, oh, I don't want to see it because so-and-so isn't in it anymore. So making the show the star became an important thing in musicals. So that's really changed, because in the 60s, you would never think of doing a musical without a star. It was very rare to see that happen. It happened, of course, but not very often. There was somebody above the title, somebody you wanted to see. By the way, I'm hearing, this doesn't make it true, but I'm hearing that when Mr. Lane leaves the Addams Family, it's not impossible that Robin Williams is going to take over. We'll see. We'll see. This is what I'm hearing.
You know, Addams Family may or may not need Robin Williams. They seem to be doing good box.
Yeah, of course, the question becomes why they're doing good box is another aspect of it. But nevertheless, they may have learned something from the producers. Because producers, I bet, could have run a long time if they spent the money on stars.
It's funny you bring up the star casting thing, because we just saw the news this week that Douglas Hodge and Kelsey Grammer re-upped for Lacage that we expected. And in getting back to the kind of the underlying conversation of having something that is just so out there that makes people stare at it. My wife and I were talking just this morning about why these television shows like the Wives of New Jersey or whatever it's called, and why people watch this stuff, because it's just like a train wreck happening. But Matthew linked to something this week on his, I think it was on his Facebook page, if not his Twitter feed, about that television show.
This
Is Your Life. I didn't want to give away all this stuff to it, but I think
we can put it on the show page. Sensationalism has been going on a long time.
Why don't you fill people in a little bit on the backstory? I didn't want to give it away because
uh,
It was shocking.
I don't really want to because I think it's creepy. But basically, I have to be honest. I haven't seen that many episodes of This Is Your Life, so it really is something that Peter would probably be a little bit better equipped to talk about. But basically, they would bring people on who were famous or
infamous.
Notorious in some way, and then bring out other people who would talk about them and, you know, certain aspects of their life. So one day, I don't remember if it was, you know, I don't remember what day it was. It was August 6th that I saw this story. Perhaps those of you with good memories of history, you know where I'm going with this. But they had a Japanese survivor of Hiroshima This Is Your Life. Peter, did you see this?
But as soon as you said August 6th, I knew that was... Exactly.
You're very astute in that way. I hope our listeners are too, because that's an important day. But anyway, so they had a survivor of Hiroshima on, and one of the guys that they brought out for This Is Your Life was the pilot of the Enola Gay, which, wow. To me, when I read that, my jaw almost literally dropped. I just...
You mean the fact that they had them both on the same? They had them
and
both.
They had them shake hands. They had them.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, this is possibly somebody who was responsible for killing this person's family or friends or loved ones.
Wow.
And I know that emotions run high in times of war, but it just goes to show us that this quote-unquote reality television thing didn't start with Survivor, you know, on CBS 10 years ago. This has been going on for many, many years where the entertainment industry feels that we have to heighten the bar just a little bit more to get more hysterical than the next person, to do something more outrageous than the next person.
Fascinating to me, because I had never even thought of that This Is Your Life was a reality show. I mean, I remember This Is Your Life from the 50s. I remember my parents wouldn't let me watch it because it was on, I believe, at 10 o'clock on Wednesday nights and go to bed. But I also remember one time my mother talking about the fact that Loretta Young, who was a big star in the 30s and 40s, was on the show. Now, the one thing that you have to understand about This Is Your Life is it was like a surprise party. The person didn't know that a man named Ralph Edwards would show up and say, Loretta Young, this is your life. And people were going to come on and they're going to talk about, I knew Loretta when she was 15. I knew Loretta when she was 25. I worked with Loretta here and there. And that's what it was. People coming in and chatting. And I didn't see this happen, but my mother said, Loretta Young said, absolutely not. I am not having this happen to me, and walked off, and they didn't have a show. That had never happened before. And, you know, it's funny because now it's come out that Loretta Young had Clark Gable's illegitimate child. And so maybe that's what she was afraid of, you know, that somebody was going to come out and spill the beans on that. It's entirely possible. But it's funny, I never thought about that. But, I mean, I remember seeing episodes of This Is Your Life as time went on, and we accepted it as just another television show. But now that you bring it up, it really was, or could have been, hot stuff. But I never heard about that Hiroshima thing, which is fascinating and grisly.
To bring this back to the theater, the reason I brought it up is we talked about With Glee on the last podcast, and someone wrote into all that chat and really trashed it and said, at $50 a ticket, sweet and okay isn't really enough, is it? I give everyone an A for good intentions and putting their hearts into it. I saw it with a full house, and there were certainly not a house full of people having a rip-roaring good time. And I wrote back and I said, well, you know, I mean, did people have a rip-roaring good time at She Loves Me or Carnival? You know, I mean, does every show have to, like, just knock you into the next week with its, you know, with huge sets and spectacle and
but I do believe the key words in that post were $50, you know, and I do think that's what has come, because it's become so expensive that people really want to see that money represented. Speaking of 50, that was probably about what me and my girl charged when it opened in 1986, and I remember feeling the satisfaction in the theater after the opening number that they put, you could see the money they spent, and people were relaxing, saying, "Oh, we're going to get our money's worth. Look at these nice sets." I felt it, and I mean, I saw Me and My Girl a number of times because I'm very fond of it, and I could always feel that audience genuinely relax, knowing they weren't going to get, you should pardon the expression, screwed. That they had put out a lot of money, but at least they were going to get their money's worth. So I think if theater tickets were far less expensive, we wouldn't have this mentality of it's got to be sensational beyond belief.
At well, that's
prices,
an excellent
it just
point.
Can't be a pleasant, yeah, it just can't be a pleasant evening anymore. So, and with that, I'm off to the airport. So, friends, good talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again, and we'll talk soon.
All right, Peter. Thanks so much for taking so much time this morning.
Bye.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
All right. So off-Broadway, we Michael and Matthew got a chance to see Secrets of the Trade. So Michael, why don't you start us off there?
Well, it's a very interesting play by Jonathan. You know, I've never known exactly how to pronounce his last name. It's either Tollens or Tollens.
I would personally say Tollens for
I
what
believe,
it's worth.
I believe so. I really should learn how to pronounce his name. And it's at Primary Stages, and it has an excellent cast. John Glover plays this sort of veteran Broadway director writer, and this kid who's wonderfully played by Noah Robbins, who starred in the all too short-lived Broadway production of Brighton Beach Memoirs, writes him a letter, basically a fan letter, and offers to be his assistant. And the kid writes this letter when he's like 16, and nothing happens right away. But then about 2 years later, out of the blue, he gets a letter from the director or writer asking him to meet, and they meet. And it's sort of, it's very interesting because it's sort of like a mentor relationship, but then you keep wondering for a long time whether the actor director, you know, sort of has a sexual interest in the kid. And what's interesting is that it doesn't turn out to be like a black and white kind of situation there. You know, and there are elements of that, but it's not primarily what he was after. I don't want to give away too much. And it's also sort of how, you know, a protege can learn a lot from the mentor and then eventually surpass them in some ways. Not an all about Eve thing, but just how you know, the new people rise and the old people eventually sometimes just kind of fade away and hit on hard times.
It's very entertaining. I had a very good time at it. The cast, as Michael said, is really terrific. And I hope he doesn't start disagreeing with me when I say this, but Noah Robbins really reminded me of a young Lonnie Price. He had a lot of the same kind of vocal characteristics and the sort of awkward, funny Jewish thing going on. And I actually thought that he was, I mean, I thought he was terrific in Brighton Beach Memoirs. And I actually thought he was might have even been just the teeniest, tiniest bit better here, because the play takes place over a course of, I don't know, 8 to 10 years, something like that. And he really made kind of a good show of growing up over that period of time. It's, I have to say, though, that for whatever reason, I found it a little bit unsatisfying. I had a really good time in it, and it's a well-told story, and the characters are very vivid, and John Glover in particular is excellent in his role. And the two actors who play the parents, Mark Nelson and Amy Aquino, they have also a number of ensemble roles that they play that are very funny and that really kind of give them a piece of the action that they might not otherwise get, because the parents are really sort of supporting in terms of their function in the story. But the second act really got into a bunch of weird kind of ugly-ish sort of places that I felt weren't really justified by where it was at the beginning. It really is very much a comedy and very much kind of a lighthearted but serious-minded look at the artistic process from, as Michael said, people who are on their way up and people who are on the way down. But there's also sort of a side story about the gay mindset during that period of time, because Michael, I can't remember if you said this, but the John Glover character is gay and is relatively open about it. He basically subscribes to that theory that David Hyde Pierce once said about, my life is an open book, but don't expect me to read it to you. It's that kind of thing. He doesn't advertise it, but he doesn't hide it. And that starts to play a very important role over the course of the play. And in the second act, it starts to take over the story. And I didn't like that because I felt that is sort of limiting what the play and the story and the characters can be. And to me, the much more interesting story is the kind of macro, wide sweeping view of mentors and mentees and the idea of passing on knowledge and what you owe to the people who came before, what the people who came before owe you and what they don't owe each other, because they have different expectations of each other and they might think that there are certain boundaries that they can and can't cross, and perhaps they're not necessarily right about that. And perhaps the knowledge of, or perhaps that misunderstanding causes problems that it really shouldn't, whereas if people talked to each other and understood each other better and didn't have the same kind of expectations, then maybe the problems that arise wouldn't necessarily happen. And to me, that was really the more interesting part of the story. Now, the thing about Jonathan Tolens is he has something of a reputation as being a gay playwright because of The Last Sunday in June, which was off Broadway a number of years ago, 5 or 7 or something
like
that.
And his first big hit, Twilight of the Golds.
Which I don't know at all, Michael. So is that another gay play? I hate to admit that, but... Well,
in a sense, yeah, I think it's his best play. Do you know what the plot of that is?
No, I know nothing about it, I have to say. I'm sorry.
It's about a woman is pregnant and her brother is gay, and it turns out that they have a test in order to determine what the sexual orientation of the child will be. And it's determined that it's going to be a gay male child. And the question is whether or not she's going to abort it. And so, obviously, the brother has a lot to say about that. It's a really good play.
Okay, well, that's good. I need to look that up. But anyway, so as Michael is pointing out, he has a reputation as a gay playwright, and that I think that puts. I already use this word. I hate to use it again. I think that limits what Secrets of the Trade can be. I'm not saying that one or more of the characters can't be gay or even that they shouldn't be gay, but that by making it a gay message play, which I think ultimately is what it is, I think that by making it a gay message play, which ultimately it struck me is what it is, it reduces the impact of it for larger audiences. And I do think that's too bad. It's with The Last Sunday in June, he had a point to make about a completely modern sort of gay retelling of The Boys in the Band. And structurally and thematically, that worked better. I just think that the conflicting stories of the mentor-mentee relationship and the gay mentor-gay mentee relationship, as the case may be, just sort of overwhelms what could have been really a touching kind of story. And there's still a lot of parts about this that are touching and are very thoughtful. But in the second act, I just think he overloads the gay aspect of it and sort of washes away the larger theatrical story. So I didn't particularly care for that aspect of it. That isn't going to bother some people, but to me, it's such a change from the first act, because the first act ends with the two of them, the older actor and the younger actor. It ends at kind of a crossroads in their relationship, as it were, when something happens to one of them that changes the way the other one looks at him. And it's like Jonathan Tolens doesn't really know how to recover from that. It's a great curtain moment, but it changes the nature of the rest of the play so much that the kind of carefree first act idea where you think you know what the story is going to be, you think you know how it's going to unfold, and you think you know what it's about, turns out it's about something very different. And again, there's not a problem with that sort of change, but I think it needs to be justified a little bit better than it is. But there are a lot of very good laughs in it. The acting is very good. The directing by Matt Shakman is excellent. The set is by Mark Worthington. It's a wonderful kind of theatrical evocation of drops and travelers and set pieces and things like that really kind of evokes the the theater economics of the early 80s and, of course, the early 2000s as well. So it's an enjoyable play. I had a good time. I think it will probably get some good reviews, and I think that it will entertain a lot of people, and that's good. But it's not really going to – but I found parts of it unsatisfying, and that's too bad. But there's a lot of artistry there, and it really shows that Jonathan Tolens is a smart and a thoughtful playwright, and I certainly hope we see more of him. This is only the second of his plays I've seen, and to hear Michael tell it, I missed out on a great one with Twilights of the Gold, so I hope I have another chance to see what he can do.
You should read it if you find it.
Yeah, I would love to.
Yeah.
Check it out.
All right, so the next show we want to talk about is Wolves at 59 East 59. Michael got a chance to see that. Tell us what you thought, Michael.
Well, the play is by a wonderful playwright named Delaney Britt Brewer, who is a female playwright. And I had seen a play of hers a few years ago called An Octopus Love Story that I really, really liked. And so I made a point of coming back to see this show, which was also at 59 East 59th in the black box space upstairs. And she's, honestly, it's actually three linked plays performed one after the other, and with one intermission between the second and the third one. And some of the characters continue and some of them don't. And it's basically a relationship play. I did have problems with it. I didn't feel like it totally hung together, and the last play really confused me. I still have to find out what it meant. but the thing about Delaney Britt Brewer is she's able to write such wonderful natural dialogue, and she also, or whoever her director, they're able to come up with these really amazing actors to play the dialogue. I'm always amazed by the level of acting talent in New York, which I guess I shouldn't be, but there are so many people who are so good, you know, and it's good to, that's one of the reasons why I try to spend as much time as possible off Broadway, because there's such a pool of talent out there, and it's wonderful to get to see these people have opportunities. So I do recommend to you all, if you tend not to go beyond Broadway to see shows, do try to do so as much as possible, because you really might be incredibly pleasantly surprised. And if you're not surprised, and if you don't like what you see, you won't be out $125 a ticket.
That's a good point. You know, we've been talking a lot this summer about some really great performances off Broadway. If you are able to, you know, find a reviewer that you fall in sync with, whether it be Michael or Matthew or Peter or, you know, some of the other reviewers who are out there, Adam over at Time Out or even Brantley at the Times or whoever, you know, if you feel like you have the same taste as them, you can trust some of the lesser known projects that they review, which is really, you know, you can find some really great things out there, and you can really end up in some really bad things as well if you go to off-Broadway. And you can end up in some really bad things if you go to Broadway as well, if you just don't know, you know, what you're getting into it to start with. So, Matthew, you got to see two other shows that we'll mention today. Why don't you give us an intro on them?
Well, the first is Foreplay, and that's not Foreplay. It's four, as in the number four, play. And it's at the Minetta Lane. It's a show by the Flying Karamazov brothers, who are a juggling quartet. And really, it's exactly what the people there would lead you to believe. It's a 90-minute, 100-minute show about juggling. And if that sounds boring, it's not really. It's unlike a lot of the other kinds of shows that have been showing up in the larger off-Broadway theaters recently, like Union Square, where they'll bring in a performing troupe from somewhere else, like Korea or whatever, with Cookin', or that one about the family who's all the martial arts experts. I don't even remember the title, or the Mayumana B that was there a few years ago, where these are performance arts kind of spectacle things that you don't need to know English to really understand. And in fact, a lot of the people who are in them aren't Americans or even native English speakers themselves. With this, these are all people who are from America and who, in a number of cases, are from New York. So it's really a show that is aimed at Americans by Americans. And as such, it has a lot of talking in it. There's a lot of commenting about how juggling is like music and about how each one of them wants to accomplish a certain thing through music or through juggling. And it builds up over the course of the evening as they do a bunch of juggling of all sorts of different things, like bowling pins, and they have a black light number, and they juggle things that the audience has brought in themselves at one point, and until at the very end when they have this whole thing where they juggle 9 objects of terror, as they call them, which include a block of dry ice and a lit torch and an egg and a salt shaker and things of, and a meat cleaver and things of that nature. So it really is just a fun sort of lark of an afternoon, but it's a little bit deeper than some of these other shows, because the people in it are really taking care to make sure that there's a narrative and that there's a point to it. So it's not completely escapist, but it's not going to be anything that it's going to change your life, basically, unless you really like juggling, in which case you may have one of those, oh, I can do that kind of moments. Although I don't know who could juggle some of the things that they juggle in the show. I will say, though, that when I saw this yesterday afternoon, and we're recording this on Sunday, so this was Saturday afternoon, had one of the most inconsiderate audiences I have seen. And it's not so much, it wasn't that cell phones went off or people were texting or anything like that. I didn't see that. But during the section of the show where the audience is supposed to bring up on stage the things that they wanted the performers to juggle, people were throwing up literal bags of garbage. I'm plastic bags with leftover food containers in them and plastic water cups and things like that. And My feeling is these are artists who made a request for you to bring specific things for them to perform with, and people are just using the stage as their own personal trash can. That bothered me. But the thing that actually scared me was during the second act on 3, and I swear to God, I am not exaggerating, and I can name people in the audience who will verify this, 3 separate occasions during the second act, people either threw or quote-unquote accidentally dropped from the mezzanine things into the orchestra. There was one such time where it was like 3 different playbills all at the same time. Someone else dropped a full drinking cup down onto the orchestra where it broke, literally 3 inches away from a seat where there was some adolescent kid sitting. And then there was another, I don't remember what the 3rd thing was, but it almost hit me on the head. It came down right next to my seat. And I don't know if it's a case of people not caring or not paying attention or if they were really just accidents. But whatever it is, I mean, if you're sitting up in the mezzanine, you have to remember that there are people downstairs. And in the Minetta Lane, which is a small theater, I think it probably seats 498 people, something like that. Not any more than that, that's for sure. It's a very small theater, and even there, you drop things from the mezzanine, people can get hurt. And even worse, people can get hurt and it disrupts the show. So really be careful if you're sitting up in the mezzanine or anywhere, because you're going to ruin the show for other people too. The other play that I saw was Abraham Lincoln's Big Gay Dance Party, which is basically what it says, except it's not a musical. It's actually a play. The idea is that a school teacher in a suburban Illinois puts on a Christmas pageant about the presidents, because obviously you can't deal with Christmas in a lot of the public schools anymore appropriately. So they do this, and then the character, the young actor who's 14, 15, something like that, playing Abraham Lincoln, comes out and starts talking about his relationship. I don't remember his name, and I'm not going to look it up right now, but starts talking about his relationship with a gay man in his life, and this causes a big hue and cry in the community, where everyone gets really upset, and they run the teacher out of town on a rail, figuratively speaking, and then a bunch of other people come in to sort of deal with it. There's a Republican representative, a former Republican representative who now lives in the town and is sort of leading the charge against this. There's the black Republican candidate for governor, who is also a state senator, who comes in to sort of defend the teacher. And then there's a New York, I guess it's worth saying, gay reporter from the New York Times who comes in to write a story about the trial. And the kind of gimmick of the night is that the story, you see the story from all three of those different perspectives, but you see the same events. You just see different kinds of angles on them. And the audience, a member of the audience, gets to decide who gets to decide the order in which you see the story. And this is apropos of absolutely nothing, but when I saw the show, for those of you who watch the Food Network, Bob Tuchman, however you say his name, was the guy who was chosen at random to do this, and he chose the order of the show. So it was kind of interesting from that standpoint. But I have to say, if it weren't for the gimmick, this would not really be a very remarkable story. This is the kind of thing that we've seen on stage a number of times. And there's an element of the avant-garde to it, because as the title suggests, there are dance elements in there that have very little to do with the story. They sort of are interludes and have very, very faint thematic connections to what's going on. But it's not a dance musical. The dance is not crucial to the story. The story is really about how small communities and how larger cities deal with things like this happening, and what the role of the teacher is, and so on. And that's worth talking about. But the play itself is really rather unexceptional, and it is 2.5 hours long. I think that is too long for this. I think that you can get away with the three sides of the story thing if you have a really compelling story that deserves to be told from three sides. But two of the sides are almost identical, and because the Republican representative and the state senator are both running for the governor's seat, so you get a lot of crossover action there. And I have a feeling that could probably all have been compressed, and either a new character added, or they could have found a way to work in the other story of the reporter and just made it a single narrative evening rather than keep swapping around like that. The gimmick tends to overwhelm the story because you keep meeting characters that you already know, and they keep talking about events that you've already seen that aren't really that spectacular. And on the very few occasions when you do see something of note from a different perspective, it doesn't really shed a lot of additional light on it. It just sort of just moves the camera 5 feet to the left or the right or whatever, but doesn't reveal a lot of new insights into what's going on. So from that standpoint, I did not particularly love it. It's well done, and there's some good people in it. Stephanie Pope Caffey is, some of you may know, a very well-known Broadway dancer and singer in musicals. She plays the governor, and Arnie Burton, who's in the 39 Steps and the off-Broadway production of The Temperamentals, is the reporter. It's enjoyable. It's directed by Chris Smith. I guess it originated in L.A., and it has very much that kind of sensibility to it, the Bat Boy type of sensibility that has characterized L.A. musicals in New York. It's not bad, but I kept expecting it to go a little bit deeper than it eventually does. And I personally have no idea whether or not Abraham Lincoln was gay. I don't know if it matters, but it's an interesting idea for a show. But I think that if you have an interesting idea, you still need to do interesting things with it. And for me, Abraham Lincoln's Big Gay Dance Party did not quite go that far.
Matthew, is everybody in the cast dressed up as Abe Lincoln?
At some point or another, yes, they are. There are seven people, and they make a big show of them wearing the long black coats and the tall black hats and fake black beards and stuff like that. And that's when they do a lot of the dancing as Abe Lincoln's. So, yeah, that's of course, the question is that crucial to the story? And I'll leave that for other people to argue as well. For me, it wasn't.
Well, maybe if Susan Stroman had directed it.
Perhaps. That solves the problems of most shows, except Thou Shalt Not and Young Frankenstein. So.
Exactly. All right. So I guess we'll wrap it up from here. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo, and there's a subscribe button right there. That way, each and every time we have one of these episodes, it'll be automatically downloaded to your iTunes, so you won't miss anything. If you want to give us some feedback, and we've been getting a lot of it, we welcome all your feedback, good and bad, indifferent, or if you tell us if you really like Abe Lincoln's Big Gay Dance Party. You can also go right above that subscribe button on the front page of Broadway Stars and send us an email, or you can give us a call at 646-873-7695 and leave a voicemail. And if you do leave a voicemail, we may play it on the show. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, who is now driving Mr. Kander, and Michael Portantier and Matthew Murray, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to our show. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks.
He got friendly holding my hand. Well, she got friendly down in the sand. Oh, sweet. Just turned 18.
But she was good. You know what I mean.
Ow! Summer heat. Boy and girl.